Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. We've been talking a lot about flowers and how to use flowers to help control pests in your garden. It's a big world out there. There are lots of different kinds of pests in the yard that we want to deal with in lots of different ways. A lot of these can be dealt with very well with other insects and with other creatures that you may not see as insects, like little things like mites, even native viruses, native bacteria. All of these things are working with you if you allow them. But the structure of all of this, that almost all all of these creatures depend on, and that's very important if you're going to do that, build this, is to have flowers, and lots of flowers. And we talked about how to do that. There's a couple of things that I warned you about with flowers. One, if you have a rose, let's think about how a modern rose looks. You can't, it's just a bunch of petals. Now, insects can't make use of petals. They may be attracted, they may try to find it, but what they're looking for is pollen inside that rose. And a lot of modern roses have no pollen, because all of their stamens that produce the pollen have been turned into petals. I know that sounds weird, but that's what we've done. We fiddled with the breeding. If you've ever seen an old-fashioned rose, a really old rose, or a wild rose, how does that rose look? Cherokee roses, sometimes we call them. They're not native, but they grow wild. And some of the other roses, you ever notice that they have all of those, they have that little bristle of stamens right in the center? They don't have petals that fold it over and hide it. It's open, centered. Those are the kinds of flowers we're looking for. Camellias often don't get pollinated anymore because we've chosen these flowers, camellia flowers, that have these big, fat, multi-petal centers, which are very pretty, there's no question. But they don't help insects, because all of those petals are the result of converting pollen-producing parts of the plant, nectar-producing parts of plants, into artificial petals, into these petals that make the flower look fluffy. So if you wanted a camellia to attract the kinds of things that camellias attract, you want it to have an open center with the stamens, with that big fluffy growth of little bristle, like a little comb or a brush of stamens in the center of the plant. That's what the insects need, and that's what they're looking for, and that's what you're looking for in terms of your flowers. And we also said, don't go with double flowers. Be careful about flowers that you buy at the store, because sometimes they have insecticides embedded in them. And three, here's the other thing. Look for plants that produce a lot of little flowers. Something like a sunflower actually may seem like one big flower, but it's actually composed of many little bitty flowers. That's really good. Tithonia, Sean, I'm absolutely great. And Sean and Wemo, I don't know whether there are two Seans telling me about Tithonia. I think they both have great pictures of Tithonia in their gardens and marigolds. They're great. Tithonia is great. The Mexican sunflower is really good. Carol, I'm going to talk about the commercial wildflower mix in just a minute. But let's go to Bruce here real quickly. Bruce, I'm listening.
Hey, good morning, Bill.
How are you?
I'm good. I've been working on this insect thing for attracting beneficials for a while, and one of the things I come up with was timing, and I couldn't find the spring flowers early enough. So I've decided to let my winter crops bolt, like the kale, collards, the radishes, the arugula, stuff like that, bolt to feed the early plants. I kind of did that last year, and I didn't pay attention to it, and they got overwhelmed with caterpillars.
Yeah.
I really don't want to spray the BT on them. So I just cut them down when they get overrun again, or?
Yeah, so a lot of those plants are going to get overrun by caterpillars, and there's not much you can do about that if you're not going to use BT. Anything you could use to control those pests at this time of year is going to be a problem. I think you're just going to have to let the pests kind of go at it and let them flower for as long as they can. If that's the only purpose you have for those plants. I guess I wouldn't use BT. There is the possibility that you could have some butterflies out that you did want to protect. So, and the BT would kill those butterflies, or at least kill the caterpillars of the butterflies. That's an interesting question. I think it's a losing battle. As once those spring caterpillars come in, even with BT, I think it's very hard to control. So I'm not sure I'm going to be able to help you keep those flowers going. I'll also tell you one other thing: the flowers from those winter flowering plants are going to go to seed pretty quickly. So they're going to stop, even if the insects don't stop them, they're going to stop of their own accord. So we probably do need to have some other plants. So Bruce, let me say, before we get too far down that road of trying to figure out how to do something that I don't know how to do, because it's going to be really hard, I think. But let me say, let's go back. Seeds, Bruce, man, they are, you just got to get started because they're so easy, and you could have lots of seedlings ready to go out this time of year. You know, you could have your marigolds ready to go out this time of year, and you'd be set. So think about starting some seedlings. If you got a good sunny place in the house, you can do it, and just get some of those things going. Start them back in January. Don't wait for Walmart and Home Depot, because they don't know where you are. They don't know anything about gardening here. They don't know that you need these pollinators early. They're trying to sell plants in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Okay. And
I've got the winter grasses blooming out there in the winter, weeds or whatever, and I'm letting them bloom. I got Southern Cordalis and chickweed, henbane, and that geranium. And I'm going to leave them to go as long as they can until I need the space to plant in. Is there any other ones I need to get? Or
I would definitely find something. If I'm going to plant seeds, I would definitely find something that is attractive to me as well as to the pollinators.
Right.
So I would be starting right now. Here's what I would do. I think you can get some cosmos. Find some cosmos that come into bloom pretty quickly, and go ahead and sow you some cosmos, because they'll be up and blooming really quick. In another few days, by the 1st of March, you'll be ready to plant zinnias. Zinnias are great. And don't look for the big fluffy zinnias. Look for the open centered zinnias. They're really good for that. And then by the middle or late March, you can start sowing things like Tithonia, and that'll really keep things going when you need them most. So you're going to need a lot of those flowers. If you're growing tomatoes and peppers and other things, squash, you're going to need a lot of these other flowering plants. About late April and May is a key time. So if you did that schedule, you'd have all of these ready to go then. And then next year, for flowering plants this time of year, I think a lot of those spring weeds are very useful. I applaud you for thinking about that, because the chickweed in particular would be very good. And I'd have to think about, there probably a couple of, Erigeron, the fleabane daisies, which are out there, would be excellent for spring. A lot of people have those in their yards just coming up wild. And there's, you know, I'm gonna think through it through this next break, and then I'm gonna come up with a lot of the other spring weeds that I would think would be very good for pollinators. So, Bruce, that's good. I got to take a break. I'm gonna be back. Can I help you with anything else, Bruce?
No, I think that's it.
Great. Well, I'm gonna come back and talk a little bit more about that.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, so this is fun. This is fun thinking about the spring weeds. And some of them that I really haven't mentioned, but they're kind of good. You know, sometimes we go around the planet and what we've got is right here at our feet. And the chickweeds are great. Cleavers. I don't know. Do any of you have cleavers? They're those little things, the stick tights. I think that's another name for them. It's kind of gallium. Gallium is really good at hosting pollinators. They're in the bedstraw family, the coffee family. They're actually relatives of coffee. Does that help you make you feel better about them? They're bedstraw, which is the coffee family. Cleavers, stick tights, are really cool, and they produce the kind of flowers that insects really, they're really small, but they're going to be coming up, and they're in your garden. You know, the dandelion relatives, which we call them dandelions, even though they're not true dandelions. The interesting thing in Mobile is that we actually don't have many of the true dandelions in our yards. A lot of the things that we call dandelions are relatives of dandelions, but they're not. They're a whole set of plants that are sort of native to the New World. They're native to North America. They're native to Alabama, unlike dandelions, which are from Europe. And they do very well for us. They have little yellow flowers, and they can turn into little puffballs, much like dandelions. The puffballs look a little different than dandelions. But they're coming up this time of year. They're really good, too. All of those things are good for pollinators. So, Carol, one of the things you could do is just have a little place in your yard where you allow weeds with little small flowers to come up. Grasses, by the way, are not going to provide pollen for most insects because they don't have showy flowers. So grasses don't work that well for attracting a lot of pollinators or a lot of predatory insects that go along with those pollinators that are beneficials for your garden. So grasses aren't so good, but there are a lot of other flowers that have small flowers. Some of them are quite showy. Some of them are not so showy, but it's those small flowers with little petals that really can be very good at attracting insects. Really incredibly important. This is, and this leads into another question, which I got, which is very good, very appropriate for now. What about this thing called companion planting? Companion planting, David, asked me, is there any basis for understanding companion planting? Well, yeah, not in the conventional sense that we often read about on the internet or in books, where it says, "Oh, well, if you plant basil next to tomatoes, they enhance each other's growth." You know, I think that's malarkey. What I do know is that having diversity in a garden can make a lot of difference. And sometimes mixing plants up can make a lot of difference. And that can be beneficial because you don't create a target with just one plant. And sometimes there are interactions that are really hard to describe, but they do occur. So, you know, having marigolds next to certain plants can be very beneficial because those flowers attract thrips, which can come in contact with the mites, which then the mites parasitize the thrips, etc. That is useful, but the idea that growing certain plants by certain plants is going to help isn't a good idea. Here's a more important thought. There are certain types of plants that attract certain types of pests. And when you plant them all together, they're going to be much better at attracting those pests over, and when you plant them in sequence over a long period of time. So if you were to plant tomatoes in the same place year after year after year, this is important to think about. What's going to happen is you're going to concentrate the pests and the diseases that on those tomatoes, and you can have real problems. You can have real problems. There's some ways around it, and I can tell you about them, but let's just say you don't know those ways and you're going to plant the tomatoes every year in the same place. You're really going to get a huge accumulation of tomato diseases, particularly root diseases, but nematodes and other things. So you say, okay, well, I'm going to alternate them with peppers. Well, you might get it's a slightly different sweet, but they're very closely related. So they're going to have similar problems. So one of the things I do try to think about is growing, is not, so if I'm growing beans one year, I don't grow beans or peas or anything related to beans and peas the next year in that place. I'm going to grow something else, whether it's tomatoes and peppers and eggplants. Maybe I grow them all together in that spot so that I don't begin to accumulate diseases. So that's one way to think about this is how do you plant groups of plants that attract very different sorts of diseases and insects. And that's another story, and I think if you get that's it's more important to get that right than to think about what plant is growing next to another plant at any one time, because I don't think that has as many benefits. Just a thought. Charlie, we don't have any callers, right? I'm gonna go to some of the text now. How far should flowers be from other crops? And this is a great question. This is a really interesting question. I don't know the answer to this. And there's a lot of debate about it. And I actually don't think there's one answer. I think there are probably many answers depending on what kind of crops and what kind of flowers. Sometimes it's better to have your flowering plants that provide the beneficials at some small distance from your vegetable garden. You don't need to have it right next door. In fact, I see no real benefit in having these pollinators or these flowering plants right next to a tomato. Have them within 20 feet, 10 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet. That's probably ideal. So they don't need to be right next door. It probably won't hurt if they're right beside it. If they're 2 feet away, it probably won't hurt. But it's probably better to have them in their own little bed, and that's for a lot of reasons, and that's okay. So if you've got some plants in flower pots, they're probably not going to produce a lot of flowers because they're in flower pots, but that's okay. They're still going to produce some flowers in a place where you weren't going to get flowers otherwise. And if your garden is 30 feet away, that's fine. If your vegetable garden is 30 feet away, you're still going to get the benefit, at least some small benefit from those flowers. So they don't have to be in the same planters as the vegetables you want to help, because most of the insects that are beneficial that you're going to attract with flowers are flying insects. And they get around pretty well, don't they? They get around okay. So they're going to fly all around your garden. And if one of our big goals is to attract wasps, which are very beneficial, and if they're out foraging on flowers, they are not going to bother you at all. I promise you. So if your job is to attract the wasp, and they're out there and to feed them, they're going to get a little bit of nectar. They're going to deal with that, and then that's going to give them the sugar energy to go looking for the big guys. Then they're going to go after the caterpillars, and they ain't going to have any problem about flying across your driveway into the vegetable garden to look for those. See what I'm saying? So Don't plant it 100 yards away. Don't plant it 1,000 yards away. But if it's in a you know, in a normal yard, any place you plant flowers in that yard is going to be beneficial for your vegetable garden. The key is, have you got enough of them? Are you producing enough of them? Because that's really, really good. Hey, we're going to have to take a break. It looks like I got some other great questions. John in Irvington, I'm gonna come back to this. It's a really good question that I often ask myself about how many plants can I put in a pot? And I know we've got some other callers. We'll be back to them here in just a minute.
Have a little song, won't take long. Sing it right once or twice. Oh, Lord, and me, didn't I shake sugary? Everything I got is done and gone. Everything I got is done and gone. On my watch, on my chain, on everything that was in my name. Oh, Lord of me, didn't I shake sugary? Everything I got is done and gone. Everything I got is done and gone.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. So a lot of interesting questions this morning. I'd love to talk a little bit more about some of the pollinator plants and some of the things. John in Irvington asked me a very important question. John's on top of things. I mean, you know, he's that way. He takes his stuff seriously. He's got cosmos and marigolds. They're at, you know, John, they're at a great stage. I'm jealous. You're looking good. And he's got him in peat pots, and he's got, as I often do, he oversowed, to make sure that he got at least one plant per pot. And he's ended up with sometimes a dozen plants per pot. And a lot of these seeds are all coming up at the same place. What do you do about that? And I think, John, at the early stages, while they don't have true leaves, so John's plants have just got two leaves on them. Those are called seed leaves. They're not the true leaves that come out a little bit later. When they're in the seed leaf stage, I would leave them be. Just leave them be. I think they actually help each other to find some support. As long as they're not leaning over, and as long as they're getting enough sunlight and a little bit of air circulation, which it looks like they are because it looks like they might be outside, you're going to be fine. Of course, don't let them freeze. You know that. But they're going to be fine. I don't try to thin them out until I get the new leaves, until I get the true leaves, which will be the second or third set of leaves. And then you probably want to thin them out. And when you thin them out, John, of course, I don't know how you do it. I use a pair of little scissors, little teeny tiny fingernail scissors that you can kind of get in there and just kind of, you know, that you use to clean your cuticles with or whatever they do with them. I don't do that very well, I'll tell you. But you put use little cuticle scissors and you just kind of trim them out, just little bitty scissors. It's what I happen to have. Whatever, little small scissors that are easy to maneuver, and just cut them off rather than pulling them out. But I would, at this point, I think you're going to be just fine. I don't think they bother each other. I think it actually helps that they're growing together because they that resists, when you've got a lot of those roots going out, it tends to create a situation that resists accumulation of excess moisture around the root zone. It's just fine. But when they get the true leaves, then you gotta reduce the number to a pot. There's another story I can tell you about that, John, and I will come back. Because sometimes it's better to go ahead and divide those plants, but you got to space your seeds out a little better. So next time you might think about, how do I space these seeds out just a little bit better? It's hard to control, but sometimes you can space them a little bit better, and you can get two plants out of a pot. Just divide the container if you want to do that. And with cosmos and marigolds, they'll be just fine with that. They won't be unhappy. A lot of callers, a lot of texts. I'm listening, Charlie. Who's up next? Frank, tell me about this grass you're looking at.
Well, first off, I want to say I enjoy the show, and you might need to give me your hotline. I call every week, but I do listen to the podcast because, you know, Sean told me I can go back and listen, so sometimes I glean some things I need. But I've already weed and fed my, or just weeded, put some weed killer and some pre-emerge on my front yard. And I didn't think it was working, but it's killed all my weeds, but I got several types of, I guess, I don't think it's a rye, but I got grass I consider crabgrass. And I know I got some crow's foot that I can't get rid of. And I just want to, about to put out a pre-emerge, and I want to try and get rid of that crow's foot and all this crabgrass. Best way I can. I've been working on the crow's foot now. Other than digging it up, this seems to be the only way of getting rid of it.
All right. So we got a name problem. And it's important because I got to figure out what you mean by crow's foot. I'm going to work on that right now. I'm going to see how many different things are called crow's foot. Describe crow's foot to me.
You'll know what it is. My lawn looks great, but it's centipede, but it has black seeds, looks like a crow's foot, comes right up, and after a little bit of rain, the lawn looks great, except for several patches, I got something that's almost a foot tall. It's got the black seeded. And it's three-pronged seed pods, and everybody says it looks like a crow's foot is how I got the name, and I did find some information on it. I even bought some, I won't be able to say it, but it was supposed to help with the crow's foot,
I'm worried. I'm worried. I'm worried about this thing.
I don't have my glasses on, so I can't really tell.
Let's not worry about the chemical yet. Let's figure out the plant first. Is the crow's foot thing? Or is it a type of grass that puts up a seed head?
Yeah, it's like I said. You see them all over after a rain. The yard just looks bushy a little bit, but they'll go up probably over a foot, and they'll put out some. Three little black
kind of an pods. Yeah, okay. So let's go back. You know, it's a funny thing. Did you know, and let me just bother you for just a minute. Did you know that Mobile and Baldwin counties are the center for grass diversity in eastern North America? And what that means is there aren't a dozen species of grass. There are hundreds of species of grass that are native to Mobile and Baldwin County. And there's a bunch of different kinds. And what's interesting, too, is that not all of them respond to herbicide treatments in the same way. So if you've got a grass lawn, let's think about this. Just for example, you've got a grass lawn and you want to use a herbicide. How does that herbicide know not to kill the grass in your lawn, but to kill one of the hundreds of other grasses that you've got that you don't want in your yard? It doesn't. It doesn't do it very well. And so there's a big problem when you got a grass issue. A lot of herbicides don't affect that. The only grasses you're going to affect are the grasses that are annuals with the pre-emergence. You're going to affect grasses that are annuals, that don't persist over the winter, but that have to come back from seed every year. Your St. Augustine or centipede or whatever you've got really doesn't even produce many seeds. It just kind of hangs on as a plant with the roots. But some of the other grasses can be annual weeds. It's funny because we get all of our information from other parts of the country. We know what we know about lawns because we know more about Fort Wayne, Indiana lawns than we know about lawns in Mobile and Baldwin County because, you know, we don't listen to my radio show. We listen to TV. And so it's a bit of a problem. actually, most people don't have a problem with what's normally called crabgrass in the northern states. I find that Eleusine, which is not it's not in the same genus with the crabgrass that people in Fort Wayne and Indiana have, is a bigger problem here. There's occasionally a problem with crabgrass, and you may have a problem with crabgrass. You may also have a, it sounds like you've also got a problem with Bahia. Now, Bahia is, I'm going to guess that what you're calling crow's foot is Bahia.
It is.
And so Bahia is a booger. I'll tell you, it's a booger. It's hard to deal with because it tends to grow, unless you wanted it to create a nice carpet of grass. It always grows in as a weed. Sometimes, do you have centipede grass, or do you have centipede grass, or do you have St. Augustine?
I have centipede.
Yeah, and Bahia is going to be a real booger in centipede. It's always going to be hard. But let me tell you that pre-emergent is not going to affect the Bahia at all, because
it's
a perennial, and so that's another issue. And there is not an easy way to deal with Bahia. There's not a herbicide that's going to be able to easily distinguish between Bahia and centipede. So the only way to deal with Bahia is to be able to manage your grass so that it discourages the Bahia. And if you've got Bahia in a few little places, you may just have to hand pull. I will also confess, I have a spot in my yard that for a lot of reasons got butchered over the years. It gets a lot of foot traffic, and the only thing that grows there is Bahia. And it drives me crazy when those little antennas come up. It just drives me absolutely crazy. But you know what? It's what I got. And I'm not going to, I got too many things to worry about to figure out how in the world I'm going to deal with that. And that's what it is, because it's really can be hard to deal with. If I have gone out and hand pull that Bahia,
Do you have to get the whole root? I guess you do.
It would help if you just got the top, and then the centipede might have a chance. But centipede is a weak grass. It doesn't grow very strongly. So it has a hard time competing with anything, and even when you leave a nice little space for it to grow, the centipede just kind of piddles along and says, oh, I don't know. I don't want to get up this morning. I don't feel good. And it just kind of sits there. If you had St. Augustine, it would be a little more aggressive. So if I were going to do anything with those Bahia areas, I think I might try to convert them to something besides centipede, but I got to take a break, and I'm going to have to come back and talk about it just a little bit more. Can I come back and talk about it a little bit more? Yeah. And if you can hold on, I'll try to get into a little more detail. I know I got another caller. We got to take a break. Charlie, is that break thing coming up? Is it about to happen?
And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train has hauled it away.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. So, Bruce, let's go back for just a second. So there are two types of plants in your garden in your lawn that are causing your centipede problems. Well, there are three things that are causing your centipede problems. The first and biggest problem in your centipede lawn is your centipede. It's just the sorry grass. It just doesn't grow very well. I mean, every grass has problems. It's just centipede in our climate has more than most. It's weed grower. It has nematodes and lots of other things. Frank, I'm sorry. I apologize for that. So centipede's the first problem. The second problem is your Bahia grass, and it's a booger. There's no question about it. It is very aggressive. It's going to it's going to really want to compete with that centipede grass, And if I could tell you to go in and I could tell you, well, just herbicide the bahia grass. Get rid of it. Put Roundup on it, which is what some websites say. But then what's going to happen? What's going to happen is everything but the centipede is going to fill that space in because the centipede doesn't spread very. It doesn't spread very aggressively. So, and your third problem are the annuals. And the annual weeds are the easiest ones, though in centipede they're tougher than some. And your pre-emergent is helping make, as long as there isn't a bare space, though, as long as there isn't bare ground that sees the sunlight, if you have any space where the ground can see the sunlight easily, where the ground isn't shaded by the grass blades over it, you're going to have a problem with those annual grasses. If you don't have any places where the ground can see the sunlight, where the bare ground can see the sunlight, you're probably not going to have that many problems with those grasses, even in centipede. So one thing I would say is raise your mower height. It's fine to mow low this time of year with the centipede, but as soon as it gets warm, raise your mower height on the centipede so that you're mowing at least 2 inches and as close to 3 inches as you can. So make sure you don't cut that centipede too low. The advantage is there is it makes the centipede a little more aggressive and allows it to compete a little better, but it also shades the ground so that those annual grasses, whether they're goosegrass or crabgrass or whatever you feel like calling it at the time, doesn't have a chance to seed in there. And that's a big help. The bahia is a bit more of a problem, but I think even with the centipede, mowing it a little higher will help it to compete with the bahia grass. One other thing, and I don't want to make this we could get into a lawn show here real quickly, but one other thing. If you're fertilizing that yard very much, you're helping the bahia more than you're helping the centipede. Centipede does not use fertilizer well. And in fact, if you're using heavy doses, if you're using a weed and feed, you're probably damaging the centipede and helping the bahia grass. So be very careful about that.
I raised my mower deck a couple of years ago and I heard it on the show, and that definitely does help, and it's thicker. It's just then.
Yeah.
Anyway, I sure do appreciate it very much.
Frank, thanks. And if I come up with a magic solution for bahia grass, I'm going to come on the air and tell you about it.
Okay.
I'm thinking about it. I got a problem, too. Hey, Vanna, tell me about these citrus, man. They're just driving you crazy. They're going to drive me crazy, too. Tell me about them. What's up with them?
Well, the pictures of that lumpy Satsuma that we sent you about a month or so ago.
Yeah.
I had to be out of state the next week on Sunday, so I didn't hear whether you mentioned what it was or not.
Well, you know, I saw those pictures, and you know what I said? I said, wow.
They are the strangest looking thing in my life.
They are the strangest looking things.
I've never seen degrees of this lumpiness, but the tree's never been sprayed. It's an old tree.
I've never seen anything quite like it. I thought about it. I wish to goodness that I could force John Olive on here. I hope John Olive's listening. Sometimes he does, and he'll call me and say, I don't think you could have said this. And I said, you're right, John. I wish I'd said that. And so I wish John Olive would come on and tell me what this is. I've never seen anything like it.
Really?
Did you send him
this picture?
I have not sent him the picture. I will send him the picture. I corresponded with him a while back. I'll have to send him the picture. I should do that. You're right.
Good. A picture is worth 1,000 words as well.
1,000 words. And you know what I think
so
John's going to say?
Good. Well, when you send him the picture, I'll be listening to hear what he says.
What he's going to say is, wow. I mean, because there's just not anything else you could say. I think it could be some kind of mite damage. It could be some kind of abrasion damage caused by a bird or something, and the fruit reacted. I just haven't quite seen anything like it, and I can't find any evidence of anything else quite as bumpy as those turned out to be. So
I have to agree. Yes, pretty unusual.
It's a weird one. The only other thing is a sandstorm or something that just abraded the fruit that caused that, but everything I come up with is kind of weird. There is a citrus. There are some citrus mites that are not typical. They're not the red citrus mites, the citrus rust mites that may have caused that kind of damage. But I really haven't seen any pictures that remind me of that. So, Vanna, I'm still thinking. And okay. So my word on that,
okay,
I have one word.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much.
You know what my word is? Wow. Okay. And we're thinking about it.
All right.
All right, so Charlie, you tell me I'm about to run out of time in this little show, the whole dadgum show. Folks, we're going to be back next week. We got lots to talk about. Save your calls and call me next week.